Edit audio. In the last episode of the Springfield 3, I spoke with Bart Streeter, the son of Cheryl Levitt and the brother of Susie Streeter.
So we're dealing with a murder case, not a missing persons case. But it's been classified as a missing persons case all this time. For me, it's been ambiguous loss and character assassination. And I'm kind of tired of it. I've been through enough. You can't really hurt me.
Bart has developed a distrust, not only of the media, but of the Springfield Police Department as well. Though he's quick to say that there have been two out of the many detectives that he respects. He tells me about his initial interactions with the SPD after the investigation, and that he'd spend hours at the station in hopes they'd find his family.
I was doing everything I could possibly do to be there at the police station, and I would go twice a day. I would go at my lunch break and sit and talk to Asher, and then I would go after work. I was either utterly and completely exhausted from nothing really happening, or they had stopped asking me questions. And all I wanted them to do was pull whatever I could have known out of me. See, I wanted the world to stop. I wanted everybody to stop what they were doing. We need to find out what happened here. We need to find my mother and sister and Stacy right now. So I kept pushing. I kept putting my face in front of their faces and going, what are we doing? And I didn't really care about what they were doing. I was like, what do you need from me?
In this episode, I want to talk more in depth about the Springfield Police Department and how this case was handled and what's happened since the disappearance in 1992. I'm your host, Ann Roderick Jones, and this is a bonus episode of the Springfield 3, a podcast about the disappearance of three women who forever changed a small Missouri town and the people in it. I want to let you know that I've tried reaching out to the Springfield Police Department numerous times. I've emailed with their public affairs officer, who's worked with the major over the Criminal Investigations Division, and chose to opt out of speaking to me. This has been frustrating. Like, I keep coming up against a brick wall. I was hoping that after this podcast airs, they might change their minds. So I've reached out two more times to see if they'd like to speak since the podcast was launched. In the first email, I was told that, as far as the investigation, we haven't made any reportable progress at this time. The second follow-up went unanswered. Back in 1992, Springfield Police Department worked closely with the media. I wasn't a journalist at the time, but I found someone who was. Dan Shelley reached out to me after listening to the podcast. Dan is a Springfield native and now lives in New York City. He was the one who broke the story of the Springfield 3. We met at a studio in New York City's Union Square, and this was the first in-person interview we've done in a year and a half. Talking to Dan was sort of like stepping into a time machine. I recognized his voice from the station that played nonstop on my grandparents' radio. And we talked about what it was like to grow up in the Ozarks and how much Springfield had changed. Here's how it started.
My name is Dan Shelley. I am the executive director and chief operating officer of the Radio Television Digital News Association and Foundation. I was born and raised in Springfield, Missouri. Went to high school at Parkview, went to college at Missouri State, then SMS, and began working at KTTS Radio News in 1980. Back in those days, at KTTS News, we did traffic reports in morning and afternoon drive, morning and afternoon rush hours. And the regular traffic reporter that worked on our staff had called out sick that morning, so I substituted for him. So one of the ways I would cultivate law enforcement sources, one of the many ways, especially early in the mornings, I would sometimes take them a cup of coffee. So I heard on the police scanner about this fender bender at National in St. Louis near the now Missouri State campus. I knew the officer, Corporal Steve Magruder. I stopped, I believe, at a McDonald's, got him a cup of coffee and took him the cup of coffee and just chatted with him for a minute while he was investigating this minor accident. And during the course of that conversation, he said, hey, you're going to want to talk to the detectives as soon as possible because over the weekend, three women disappeared from a home on East Del Mar. And I don't know how he knew this, but he's, especially at this early date, this was Monday morning after the disappearance, and he said, it's believed to be the only case in the United States where three adult women have disappeared simultaneously. So Corporal Magruder gave me the tip, and I immediately drove back to the radio station, and we had a police beat reporter, Karen Libby, and she had a lot of law enforcement sources too. And so I relieved her in the newsroom and asked her to go down to police headquarters. Shortly after she arrived there, she was able to confirm what Steve Magruder had told me, and we were able to go on the air with the story before Chief Knowles held a news conference, and the story blew up and became what it is today, which is one of the biggest mysteries in Ozark's history.
Okay, so let's go back to the subsequent days after this story came out, after, you know, Terry Knowles held the press conference.
Well, our news department, because we had such good law enforcement sources at the local, state, and federal level, we were able to get a lot of information, and we were able to break a lot of aspects of the story before other news media. And I want to be clear here. I mean, the folks at the News Leader, the folks at KYTV, the folks at KOLR-TV, all of the news operations, local news operations in Springfield at that time, were very robust, very aggressive, very good at what they did. We were just fortunate in that we happened to be with the right people at the right time, the right place at the right time, and that allowed us to break several important angles of this story in the early days until CBS 48 Hours parachuted into town.
We'll get to that later. Can you first tell me some of the different angles of the story that you were able to break, if you remember those?
Locations of searches that were underway. We would often get tipped off when a search was being conducted or about to be conducted. Mostly it was tips that led to searches, information about suspects that we were not able to report because it hadn't been confirmed. And, you know, one of the tenets of journalism is you don't report on or at least at the time, you don't report on a suspect's name until he or she's been formally charged. So we knew who the suspects were. We knew who was being called in for questioning. We just weren't able to report a lot of specifics at that time because no charges had been filed.
Do you remember who those suspects were now, the initial suspects?
I remember one was Bart Streeter. I don't remember the identities of any of the others, but there were three or four that we knew were being questioned and or polygraphed throughout the course of the first several weeks and months of the investigation.
In the last bonus episode, we heard from Bart Streeter. He spoke about being a suspect in the disappearance of his mother, sister, and Stacy. He also touched on his experience with the Springfield Police Department and his involvement with law enforcement in this case. Bart told me that he would go to the police station twice a day, often speaking with Detective David Asher, who we heard from in previous episodes.
I kept putting my face in front of their faces and going, what are we doing? And I didn't really care about what they were doing. I was like, what do you need from me? And I don't know if Asher was the right person for me. I believe that David Asher had a huge part in a divide and separate tactic in the beginning. And I think he communicated things that made it seem as though I was much more of a suspect than I ever really was in this case. And it was a type of police tactic that would divide me from any support and comfort. Once I saw the 48 Hours show, I was done with the Springfield Police Department. You have to understand, being done doesn't mean that I'm not looking for my mother and sister and Stacy. It doesn't mean that I'm not doing everything that I can do. But I couldn't be in Springfield anymore. I couldn't be exposed to the billboards and people walking out on their front lawn when I'm surveying their land and asking me, what do you think happened to your family? It was constantly in my face. It was devastating. And I wanted the public to be involved as much as possible. But I was not the person to be the face because I was angry. I was frustrated. I was devastated. So many people should have been looked at deeper when all I have in reference is what they did. Did they destroy me? Oh, yeah, absolutely 100%. They did.
Dan also mentioned the 48 Hours episode and when they came to town. He talks about the police chief at the time, Terry Knowles, who we heard about quite a bit throughout the season.
It really upset me when CBS 48 Hours, Richard Schlesinger and his crew parachuted into town and immediately started handing out tchotchkes, CBS News ball caps, CBS satchels, CBS branded, you name it, as I recall. And the investigators, especially Chief Knowles, seemed enamored by all the attention, national attention they were getting from CBS News. And one of the consequences of that is that local reporters were often shut out of key aspects of the investigation that CBS News was given unprecedented access to, including the polygraph test of one of the suspects at the time. I was livid that Chief Knowles, who was very friendly, we always got along, he was a great source, all of his attention, it seemed, turned to them and accommodating them and their requests. And the local reporters, who would still be around after CBS left town, were sort of left out in the cold for a while. And I was upset about it. And eventually I confronted the chief and complained. And I said, look, you depend on us. We're going to be here after CBS News is gone. Don't freeze us out. You know, what are you, nuts? He was apologetic, but he didn't change his behavior. And then CBS News finally left town. They never revisited the story in a meaningful way again. And there we were, all the local reporters, still having to follow it. But a few days after 48 Hours left town, he called me one afternoon and he said, can you drop by my office right away? So I drove to police headquarters, went to the chief's office, and inside the office was a guy in a suit I had never seen before. And the chief promptly, a retired FBI agent, promptly introduced me to, hey, this is a special agent with the Behavioral Sciences Unit. You know, the Silence of the Lambs people. He was so excited that he had a Silence of the Lambs Behavioral Sciences Unit FBI guy called in to help him with this case. And Silence of the Lambs was a movie that came out in 91. So it was still very much on everybody's mind in the summer of 92. So he introduced me to the special agent, and then he and the special agent proceeded to reveal to me a profile that the Behavioral Sciences Unit had developed on the subject. And they were very insistent that this person was a subject, not a suspect. Because in FBI parlance, if you're an unknown criminal, you are a subject. Once your identity is known, you become a suspect. And unsub, which is an unknown subject. So this profiler had developed a psychological profile of the unsub in the missing women case. And then Chief Knowles asked me to do a favor. While I was working at KTTS News at that time, I also had a weekly public affairs show on Ozarks Public Television, KOZK-TV. And the chief asked if I would devote one of my weekly KOZK-TV shows to the missing women case and have the FBI profiler on as my guest. They would not dictate the questions. They never asked because Chief Knowles knew me well enough to know that I would never have gone for that. But they told me that if I would have him on the show, I could ask whatever I wanted to ask, and the profiler would answer the questions in a way based on his profile of the unsub that he thought might provoke the suspect or subject to do something, to make a mistake. It might prompt someone in whom he had confided about the crime to come forward and do a tip. So we did an hour-long live show. We had a phone bank that was staffed by law enforcement. We told people that their tips could be anonymous. I asked the FBI special agent questions. He answered in manners that he thought were tailored to appeal to the unsub. So we got a lot of tips, but nothing ever came of it.
Do you remember the subject profile, some of the characteristics of that, that this Silence of the Lambs FBI person came up with?
As I recall, it was one subject, not more than one. It was a white man in his 20s or 30s who was a loner, most likely, who likely lived by himself, who might have been friendly to neighbors, but generally avoided contact with other people as much as possible. He may or may not have had a criminal record, which may or may not have involved violent crime. He likely was obsessed with Cheryl, likely had scoped out her house, likely knew that as a hairdresser, she worked hard on Saturdays and sometimes took large amounts of cash home with her on Saturday nights. And he'd cased the house, most important. He had a plan, he knew what he was going to do, and for some reason, he did not expect the girls to be there too.
Did that make sense to you?
It did. It made a lot of sense to me. It fit the circumstances. It fit everything we had been told about how this had happened, how it had likely happened. It seemed to fit. And it also made sense to some degree because it ran counter to a lot of the wild speculation that was going on throughout the community. This had to have been more than one person. This had to have been at least three people to be able to control and corral three adult women. But I was instantly struck in Chief Noel's office that day with the behavioral sciences guy when he said the subject, as in singular, meaning one.
There's been so much talk about Police Chief Terry Knowles, how he came in to overhaul the SPD, and how some people feel it affected this case. Dan had been in Springfield for years and had solid connections with law enforcement. I wanted to know how things were handled before Knowles stepped in.
Well, the previous two police chiefs, whom I covered before Chief Knowles came to town when I was at KTTS News, one was born and raised in the Springfield Police Department, Gordon Loveland. He had worked his way up. He was a cop's cop, but he was a Springfield guy. The second chief was Troy Majors, who came from Kansas City, where he was an assistant chief or deputy chief. And he brought a new level of professionalism to the Springfield Police Department. And then when he left and Chief Knowles was hired, all of a sudden, he told me his goal was to make the Springfield Police Department the leading investigative law enforcement agency in the state of Missouri. So he started rigorous new training regimens for a SWAT team. He brought more professional training to the police academy. He tried to turn the Springfield Police Department into his own version of the FBI, where he had spent so many years as a special agent and then supervisory special agent. So I think his motives were pure, but I think his tactics sometimes they may have been ill-advised. For example, he wanted to show off to the public a new firing range and a new training facility that he had built for his SWAT team. And they had the same swagger that Knowles did, and they'd undergone all this extra training, and they knew their stuff. And anyway, they'd built a firing range and an obstacle course. And so they allowed me and some other journalists to go through the obstacle course and to fire their weapons at the firing range. And I remember going through the obstacle course with live ammunition in the Springfield Police rifle they had given me. You go through one of these obstacle courses, you've seen them in the movies or on TV, where a picture will pop out from nowhere, and it will either be an old lady crossing the street, or it will be a woman with a baby in a baby carriage, or it'll be somebody pointing a gun at you, an evil-looking dude.
Well, I remember I was going through the obstacle course with live rounds in this weapon they had given me. And one of these things pops out, and it was a picture of me, which Chief Knowles thought was the funniest thing in the world. And I laughed about it later, but at the time it was like, what? I mean, it just scared the hell out of me. And then he let us fire their automatic weapons at the firing range. But this was a fully automatic machine gun. And so I pointed it at the target downrange. And when I pulled the trigger, there was such a kick that the gun went straight up in the air, still firing, because I was unprepared. But that's the kind of stuff that Terry Knowles would do in the name of public relations and in the names of trying to build both a better understanding for the local journalists who cover the department, some of the things that the officers had to face, but also to demonstrate to the public that this is not your grandfather's Springfield Police Department.
And so they're giving journalists who don't, some of them don't have any experience, I'm assuming, with an automatic rifle. They're giving them that gun to shoot just for press.
Yes. I remember leaving the training facility that evening. And as I was walking out the door, Chief Knowles said to me, whatever you do, don't shoot anybody tonight because you have gunshot residue on your hands from firing that machine gun. And we won't be able to catch you because we already know you have gunshot residue on your hands.
This story, the story about taking media to a firing range, just sort of baffled me. This would never happen now, or at least I don't think it would. How is it that Dan was invited to barbecues and shooting ranges, and I couldn't even get a word in with the police? Throughout these interviews, I kept hearing that the Springfield Police Department was a good old boys club. To me, this just felt like an expression, but to others, it held truth.
In Springfield, there's a good old boy club there. And it has been there for a very, very long time. This is a huge case. This is three women who were kidnapped, and there's never been any resolution whatsoever. There have been suspects taken to a grand jury with no indictment, and I don't even know who those suspects are to this day.
To put it mildly, Bart Streeter and other people we've spoken to didn't have a lot of trust in the SPD with Terry Knowles at the helm, and even beyond.
I just don't have any hope in the Springfield Police Department anymore. They have failed to solve this case for 29 years, and now they've shut everything down. But when I ask questions of the chief, which I sent last year, and I can't remember if it was 20, 21 questions I sent him, he kind of just brushed me off with, it's an active case and he won't discuss it, and he's informed his detectives not to discuss it. And it's been too long for them to do that. There's no accountability, there's no transparency. And after they publicly announced, proudly announced, that they would be taking the case to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and have a review done, they've never released any of that information into the public. And I've requested it. I requested a copy of the overall assessment of the Springfield Police Department's handling of this case from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They informed me that they could not release that, that it was to be released by the Springfield Police Department. So I requested a copy of that verbally. And then I also requested it in written form last year. And I was deeply disturbed by the response. And I feel like they're hiding something. Now understand, I don't want people to take this as though I have nobody to point my finger at and blame, and I've transferred my frustration and my anger onto the Springfield Police Department. I'm not that kind of person. I believe the community, I know the families deserve to see some accountability and transparency. What other job can you have where you fail for 29 years? The police cannot police themselves.
I asked Bart to give me a specific example of dealing with the SPD and why he feels they're not doing their job correctly. He tells me about a time in the early 2000s when he was living and working in Las Vegas.
There was a tremendous amount of money to be made there in construction, and I had reached a really, really experienced place in land surveying, and I was able to use some of the most cutting-edge equipment, and I needed to make the move. And I've got a phone call from, I believe it was Officer Higdon, asking me to take a DNA sample. And my first response was, why hasn't anybody called me earlier? Let's do this.
This was the first time you've been asked to take a DNA sample since the disappearance?
Since the disappearance. And don't let me get off subject here, but they never searched my car. Back in 1992, they never searched my car. They never searched my house. I never was interviewed by an FBI agent. So to put me out as this huge suspect and then not to follow up with these simple things, it really, at the time, I didn't wonder because I was so busy trying to be there and provide whatever they possibly needed from me. But then you have a lot of time to reflect in 29 years. And I look back and I go, this doesn't make any sense.
So what exactly does Bart want to be done? What could possibly help in finding out what happened to his mother, his sister, and Stacy?
In my personal opinion, something's really screwy and has been from the very beginning with the Springfield Police Department. Now, this many years later, I don't think it's even on the radar at all. What's happening now is they don't want their reputation being besmirched. Accountability and transparency is what needs to happen. And that's what the community and everybody else needs to force them to do. And all that takes is a letter or a phone call. And I'm begging people to make that phone call and write that letter. Send them an email. Send your congressman an email. Send the mayor an email. Send the chief of police.
Let me be clear to say that I'm not setting out to put blame on this department. I've had incredible experiences speaking with former officers who worked this case, like Rick Bookout and David Millsap and the others who were so generous with their time. But it still doesn't answer why the current Springfield Police Department won't speak with me. After speaking with Bart and Dan and the numerous other people who have sent in tips and told me that they too had contacted law enforcement over the years, I'm wondering if this is something serious or if maybe we all just want someone to blame. Our podcast has proven to reach a huge audience, so why can't I get information from them? Here's what Dan has to say about it.
And may I just say, I am upset. I am ashamed of my hometown. I am disappointed that the Springfield Police Department declined to speak with you. The only thing I can think of, and this is pure speculation, the only reason I can think that they would not want to speak to you is that they know who did it, but they can't prove it to the level of filing charges or announcing it publicly. They either know or they have a very good idea who did it. And the person may be dead now, but if the person who did it is dead now, why keep it a secret? If it's someone who's still living and maybe in prison on another charge, as has been one theory and avenue that has been heavily pursued, why not file charges? Why have the Streeter and McCall families continue to go through this agony? They need some closure. Chances are almost 100%, and I think they know this. They'll never see Susie and Cheryl and Stacy again. But they need to know what happened. And why wouldn't investigators speak with you unless they are reasonably confident they know who did it, or it would jeopardize some other investigation that they're doing?
It is about three women who were kidnapped, and it's unsolved. Let's learn from the mistakes so another family doesn't have to go through this. I think that the families, the friends, the loved ones, and the community is entitled to finding out what went wrong.
The Springfield 3 is an Edit Audio original production created in collaboration with Anne Roderick Jones. The series is written, researched, and hosted by Anne Roderick Jones. It was produced and edited by Ali Sirwaugh, with executive producing from Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and with lots of help from the rest of the amazing Edit Audio team. Theme music was written by Patrick Rindle and Ali Sirwaugh and was produced by Patrick Rindle at Studio Dolly. And thank you to all of those who reached out to us after this podcast came out and shared their stories. We really appreciate the interest and support. If you have any information about this case, please contact the Springfield Police Department or email us at hello@editaud.io.